Our first speaker is Henry Stockton, who produced a pathbreaking book, Wittgenstein and Derrida, which brought out surprising affinities between these two very, very different writers, shall we say. He's gone on to write Nietzsche's Voice and Eros and Mourning. He's come back to the study of Derrida with an essay on deconstruction in the first issue of this new journal, Derrida Today. And I gather he's completing two books, Transvaluation of Values in the Victorian Novel and Art as Techne. Henry Stockton is professor at the University of Washington in the departments of English, Comparative Literature, and Philosophy. Actually accepted as a philosopher. So, Henry, please.
Everybody this morning started out by expressing their gratitude for being here and their admiration for Martin's book, and I'm going to do the same. But I want to say a little bit more about my own personal reaction to Martin's book. It is as good as the people this morning said. But for me, it's been a particularly pleasing thing. I belong to that first generation of Derrida disciples who did not betray the master, and I have subsequent, which is so well represented here today with Jonathan and Rodolphe, and I have watched with increasing irritation for the last 20 years as these waves of readings have come out. That Martin takes on in his book and very thoroughly debunks. And I can't tell you how happy I was as I read through the pages of Martin's book and watched him show how wrong-headed these readings, which have acquired great authority, I won't rehearse the illustrious names behind them, some of whom are my friends. So I have a personal satisfaction, even glee, at the appearance of Martin's book. And of course, like everybody else, after expressing my admiration for his book, I'm going to proceed to attack it. My paper is a work in progress, and it's going to end. With only Adam Brading some questions. I got deeper in than I intended in writing this paper, and I found that I was getting into problems that I'm only going to be able to suggest at the end of the paper. As much as I admired Martin's book, in reading it, I was troubled, or more perplexed, I suppose, would be the way to put it, by the way in which, in his explanation of spacing and arche writing, Haglund treated the role of empirical writing. Because commentators on Derrida, particularly hostile ones, have persistently failed to grasp this distinction, they've often taken the writing of which Derrida makes so much to be not arche writing, but empirical writing, thereby making nonsense of the entire project of deconstruction. I'd go so far as to say that empirical writing was the great red herring in the early debates over deconstruction. And to some degree, this continues to be the case today, as we see from the case of Sean Burke's widely read critique of Derrida in his book, The Death and Return of the Author, a book that has apparently enjoyed the most remarkable success. It was published in 1993 and has been reprinted or produced new editions ever since, including a third edition just published this year. It's a very smart, very sophisticated reading of Derrida, possibly the best I've seen by a hostile critic. And yet, it's vitiated by the usual confusion between arche writing and empirical writing. So, we should close the door as tightly as we can to this type of misunderstanding by making the distinction between arche writing and empirical writing as clear and explicit as possible. And my feeling as I read Radical Atheism was that Haglund had not quite done this. He clearly had a very strong grasp of the question of ultra-transcendentality, And he stresses that archaewriting, quote, should not be confused with the empirical concept of speech, page 51. Yet at moments, he seemed to be slipping empirical writing into the place that rightly belongs to archaewriting. I wasn't sure he was in fact doing this, but there was at the very least ambiguity in his exposition. When he says, for instance, that time must be spatially inscribed, the natural reading is that time must have an external, worldly, empirical inscription. Yet, since Haglund is in these pages expounding the concept of ultra-transcendental espacement, spacing, spatial inscription might here be intended to mean the originary inscription of the not-now in the now of what Husserl calls the living present. The ultra-transcendental necessity posited by Derrida, as I've always thought, and as Haglund himself explains elsewhere, is not that experience will be written down as a spatial, worldly inscription, but rather that in itself, as such, any experience is always already a trace, a structure of inscription, prior to its empirical inscription in signs, and indeed prior to the invention of empirical languages. As Derrida says in a passage that Haglund cites 20 pages after the passage I've just cited, Derrida says, the living present is always already a trace. Similarly, the same ambiguity pops up later when Haglund says that any moment always must be recorded in order to be. When he says this, recorded would normally imply worldly empirical inscription. Yet the fact that Haglund says any and always, any moment, always must be recorded, gives his claim a transcendental form that obviously cannot apply to empirical writing, and suggests almost conclusively that he must have in mind not empirical recording, but the trace in general. Since it's obviously not the case that time is necessarily always externally inscribed, or that any moment must always be written down, it seems Haglund must intend the ultra-transcendental sense rather than the empirical sense of inscription in these remarks. Yet the tendency of the paragraph within which these remarks occur supports the latter rather than the former interpretation. He says that the experience of time is essentially dependent on which material supports and technologies are available to inscribe time, and also that the experience of space and time are constituted by historical and technological conditions, which points very strongly in the direction of empirical inscription. He does indeed seem to be saying, not that difference or the trace are the originary condition of all experience, but that empirical inscription is universally, always, ultra-transcendentally necessary. That this is in fact what Haglund means is shown by the way in which he initially broaches the question of empirical inscription through a citation from Kant's First Critique. Here, it's quite clear that Haglund is using the term spatial inscription to mean the actual physical drawing of a line. He then says that Derrida's notion of spacing is a radicalization of what Kant says in this passage. What Kant says in this passage is that time as the form of inner sense provides nothing that can be grasped in a persistent intuition. Thus, in order to grasp our own existence in the succession of temporal states, we must grasp time through outer intuition, figuratively, Kant says, by drawing a line. The act of drawing a line is extended in time, but as an act of spatial inscription, it embodies a persisting record of the succession of moments of its drawing. And in that way, we get an intuition of the temporal flow, which otherwise is unintuitable. I'm not in entire agreement with Haglund's interpretation of what Kant is saying here, but we'll set that aside. Now, in his reading, Kant is here admitting that time as pure flow has no being and must be synthesized by means of the act of spatial inscription. Nevertheless, even though Kant says that, for him, time and space remain transcendental forms of human intuition, which would be given in the same way, regardless of their empirical condition. So there's a split between this, the transcendental conception of space and time, and this act of empirical inscription. The radical Derridean conclusion that Haglund draws from this is that, quote, If time must be spatially inscribed, then the experience of time is essentially dependent on which material supports and technologies are available at a given time. That's the passage, the sentence I quoted in part before. If time must be spatially inscribed, then the experience of time is dependent on which material supports and technologies are available at a given time. According to this line of thought, there are no transcendental forms of space and time, the same everywhere and always. Rather, experience as such is constituted by historically diverse forms of spatially inscribed time and diverse forms of lived spatiality come into being as a product of these diverse forms of physical inscription. Hoglund's conclusion that for Derrida, quote, inscriptions produce the spatiality of space, is thus a strictly historicist and empiricizing thesis regarding empirical forms of inscription. But then how does the concept of ultra-transcendentality of the trace articulate with this historicist thesis? As I suggested earlier, Hoglund's account of the trace, or arche writing, suggests the thesis of the ultra-transcendental necessity that experience be empirically inscribed, and specifically in writing. He writes, quote, prior to any actual system of notation, whose application and use would be a matter of empirical need, there is an ultra-transcendental necessity that experience be inscribed in order to be what it is. This, I take it, means that prior to any actual system of writing, there is a general necessity, prior to the exigencies of empirical need, for the existence of actual inscription, inscripted systems. So that's the thesis that intrigued me and that I struggled to understand. If we accept this thesis, then the historicist account of the production of spatiality follows logically. Empirical inscription is ultra-transcendentally necessary, and the empirical, historically determinate forms of inscription that follow from this necessity produce the space-time of the trace in which we live. At first I thought that Hoglund had somehow inexplicably and in contradiction to the overall tendency of his whole book gotten this point just wrong. I was especially inclined to think this because in paraphrasing Derrida on the crucial point in question, he truncates Derrida's wording. In Hoglund's paraphrase, Derrida's claim is that, quote, inscriptions produce the spatiality of space. But Derrida's comment to which he refers, which he paraphrases, says that the possibility of inscriptions in general produces the spatiality of the trace. Not inscriptions, but the possibility of inscriptions in general. Derrida's wording seems thus to refer us directly and unambiguously to the ultra-transcendental trace, the general condition of all empirical, historically determined forms of inscription. As he says a little later, the space-time we inhabit is a priori the space-time of the trace. However, going back to the pages of the Grammatology, those are pages 26 and 27 of Radical Atheism, by the way, that I've been focusing on. But going back to the pages of the Grammatology in which the remarks from Derrida occur that I just cited, we find Derrida arguing a thesis that lends support to Hoglund's reading and which produces ambiguities that parallel those I've been tracking in Hoglund. Derrida's claim that the space-time we inhabit is a priori the space-time of the trace could mean that arche writing ultra-transcendentally determines the form of lived space-time always and everywhere as differens, or it could mean that the contingent forms of human space-time are diversely formed according to the historical forms of inscription that we happen to inhabit, and that this is necessary. The context of Derrida's remark actually supports the latter interpretation, because in these remarks, Derrida is discussing and praising Rousseau's discovery that, quote, the place of writing is linked to the nature of social space to the perceptive and dynamic organization of the technical, religious, economic, and other such spaces. So it's a very strictly historicist claim that's being made there, or historicizing. Derrida explains that he speaks of the possibility of inscription in general, the possibility of inscription in general, the phrase in which I was insisting earlier, in order to, quote, make it clear that he's referring to inscription within speech and inscription as habitation, always already situated. And here's that same ambiguity that I was tracking in Hagland, because inscription within speech suggests the ultra-transcendental trace. But inscription as habitation, always already situated, suggests this Rousseauian concept of specific historical conditions of time-space. So it seems that when Derrida says that, quote, the possibility of inscription in general produces the spatiality of space, he means both of the senses I've been tracking. As Hagland explains, time and space are for Derrida not transcendental forms of human intuition, not given in the same way regardless of empirical conditions. Rather, they are historically contingent forms of experience. Yet, at the same time, spacing, Derrida's concept that supersedes the Kantian transcendentals, is the ultra-transcendental condition of all experience, given, like Kantian time and space, in the same way, regardless of empirical conditions. While Derrida's articulation of this thesis in these pages is far from clear, I invite you to go reread them. Derrida is even harder to follow here than he is generally. Nevertheless, it does clearly indicate the curious and enormously difficult pincer movement of deconstruction that affirms absolute historical contingency on the basis of ultra-transcendental necessity. I think anyone, I don't think I'm bringing any news to any of the students of Derrida who are here today. I think anyone who studies Derrida seriously has a sense of this pincer movement. But the lack of clarity in both Hagland's and Derrida's expositions of this point shows how hard it is to give a full, explicit, logical, philosophically compelling account of how precisely this movement is philosophically articulated. Hagland's exposition has made me aware of the extremity of this difficulty. I thought I already understood this stuff very clearly, and you know, it's that I did. But then when I try to explain it, I find that I'm not exactly sure how to do it. So it sent me back to rethink the articulation of the fundamental concept of spacing by means of which Derrida introduces the deconstructive deformation and reformation of metaphysics. Hagland suggests that spacing might be the key concept in all of Derrida's thought, and this is not much of an exaggeration. So I'm going to take a closer look at the way in which spacing is used by Derrida to make the initial deconstructive breach in the metaphysics of presence. Okay, that's the end of the first half of my paper. And I'm going to turn to this new topic now. I'm going to focus on the passages from which Hagland quotes in the pages of his that I've been discussing. Passages in which Derrida argues that the exteriority called space primordially inhabits the non-spatial inside called time. And those are the pages I've given you in the handout. It's one page front and back, pages 71 and 72 of the of Speech and Phenomena, or the English translation of Speech and Phenomena, which you have there in Martin's amended translation. And it is significantly differently worded than the translation in the published version of the translation of Speech and Phenomena. Is that pages 71 and 72? What pages is it? It's not 71.
Yeah. 72.
It is?
Yeah, it starts with 71.
I ask in my question.
It was 71 and 72 in Martin's book.
In Martin's book. Okay, that's the problem.
In translation, it's
okay.
95 to 96.
95, 96. Okay, that's the problem.
No, I have the English first and the French second.
Yes, 85, 86.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm going to focus. I mean, you have the whole passage there, which is a just an enormously important passage in the foundation of deconstruction. This is a book for those of you who may not be close students of Derrida. This book was published at the same time as the Grammatology in 1967 in France. And it's in these texts that Derrida first develops the conceptual foundations of deconstruction. And this is one of the key moments in this key text. You can't imagine the excitement with which one read it at the time in the period, not in 1967 for me. But the issues that it raises, Derrida has been so well digested and absorbed and so forth, that some of these things get sort of papered over as though these are known things. We know what this is, like being in Heidegger. And it's necessary to go back and read them again and puzzle over them, I think. At least that's what I want to do today. Now, I'm going to focus on the sentences that I've underlined. I think I've got the proper sentences underlined. What I want to argue is that in the end, in passages like this, Derrida cannot be said to demonstrate or establish or even discover that the being outside itself of time is to be considered a form of spacing. Rather, he stipulates it. There is inaugural force involved in this act of stipulating, partly motivated by logical considerations, and partly an invention in language, and thus in some degree arbitrary. That's what makes it difficult, it's that little bit leap, large or small, of arbitrariness. The rules of philosophy have their own stipulations, and this move of Derrida's violates one of the most basic of these. It deforms and reforms the entire philosophical problematic of time. To say that this is a stipulation is not, however, to say that we must, therefore, swallow it whole on Derrida's say-so, or else pass it by. On the contrary, to the degree that it is, as Haglund says, and as I wholeheartedly concur, a crucial element in the architecture of Derrida's thought, the conception of the flow of time as spacing should be submitted to as much pressure as it will bear in order to test as strenuously as possible the articulation of the conceptual structure in question. So, turning to the passage itself, look at the sentence that says, since the trace is the relation between the intimacy of the living present and its outside. That's the first one I have underlined at the bottom of page 71. Since the trace is the relation between the intimacy of the living present and its outside. Notice the way in which the notion that the relation of the living present to the not now, the notion that this is the relation to the outside, is slipped in a subordinate clause that is taken as already established, conclusion already established. Since it is the case that this is spacing, the opening to exteriority in general, to the non-proper, etc. Since this is the case, but that's not the point I'm making here, right? I'm going to draw a conclusion from this. The temporalization of sense is, from the very beginning, spacing. Well, yes, once you've accepted that this is a relation to the outside, it seems to follow that we can call this spacing. But that's not the hard part. The hard part is the first part, where he slipped in the notion of the outside of the living present, which is a spatial notion already. We're talking about time, and that's precisely the question at issue, is what is the relation between space and time? And it seems to have slipped by us before we ever focused on it as a question. Go on to the next sentence. As soon as we admit spacing at once as interval or difference and as opening to the outside, there is no longer any absolute interiority. Same movement, you know, as soon as the subordinate clause at the beginning that slips in this established conclusion. Notice the difference between the two first descriptions that he gives there. We admit spacing at once as integral or difference, on the one hand, and as opening to the outside, a very different notion. Interval or difference, I think, are very well established by Derrida, by the arguments that he's been making in Speech and Phenomena. But opening to the outside? Where exactly has that been established in the way that interval or difference has been established? But now we have the conclusion. There's no longer any absolute interiority. The outside has insinuated itself in the movement by which the non-spatial insight, which is called time, appears to itself, constitutes itself, presents itself. Space is in time. And there's the resonant final nailing down of the conclusion, of the concept. It's very compelling. It's very exciting. And I think it has great power. But it hasn't been very well argued in these passages. It's hardly been argued at all. It's been slipped in. These sentences embody one of the most breathtaking moments in early Derrida, but it's almost by a conceptual sleight of hand that he establishes the notion of espacement here. The notion is arrived through the argument that A, the living present is a trace, and B, the trace is a relation to what he calls the outside. That the living presence is a trace is tightly and pervasively argued, but the question I'm asking is, what about the second? What does it mean to say that the trace is a relation to the outside of the living present? Derrida takes this as presupposed. Apparently following from a claim he makes a few pages earlier, this is the one place I found in which he sets up this conclusion. He says that the trace cannot be thought out on the basis of a living present whose life would be within itself. So he introduces that notion that for Husserl, the life of the living present is within itself. Right? So that introduces the notion of an insight, right? Which could then underwrite the notion that the life outside the living present in the not now would then be the outside. But, so, and if this is so, then the description of the trace as relation to the outside follows. But is it true that for Husserl, the living presence is, strictly speaking, conceived as an inside? Now, that's a genuine question. I would have to go back to Husserl and study it very carefully to answer that question. And maybe somebody here can answer it. But that's what you would need to fill in the argument. You would have to have that kind of thing to give that full and explicit articulation that's not given here. Because Derrida, again, just throws it in a kind of casual way. Is a now point, the core of the living present, is a now point the kind of thing that could be conceived, strictly speaking, as having an inside? It's one thing to say that the relation of a now to a not now is a relation to otherness or difference. It's another thing to argue that sameness has an interior and otherness is outside this interior. Is the notion of the outside introduced? So the question I'm asking, one might say, is whether the notion of the outside is introduced here in a way that remains merely metaphorical. I realize how questionable this question is in a Derridean context, since no one has done more than Derrida to problematize this question of what is it that is metaphorical and what isn't in philosophy, and specifically in his reading of Husserl, where he says we are, I think as the direct quotation, we are always awash in ontic metaphor. Nevertheless, even if metaphor is always at work, There are tighter and looser arguments by means of which metaphors are woven into the web of philosophical argumentation. And I'm asking whether Derrida's argument is not more loosely metaphorical in this crucial passage when he introduces the notion of spacing than it is at other times. And I think I've already indicated that I think it is. Now, it wouldn't be of major consequence that Derrida describes the relation of the living presence to the not now as a relation to the outside and as space, be it only metaphorically, if it were not that this description then expands to include literal physical space, the space of the physical world. And here's going to be a second sleight of hand that takes place. The spacing, the interval that holds the now open to the not now, is also the spacing through which Derrida says the worldly outside pours into the non-spatial inside. And that's the last sentence that I've underlined in this passage. The world, like everything that is thought under this heading, and like everything that is excluded by the most rigorous transcendental reduction, is originally implicated in the movement of temporalization. So, the relation of the now to the not now first becomes spacing, and then becomes spacing in quotation marks, and then it becomes space as worldly physical space. Although, notice that he puts world in quotation marks here. The world is originally implicated in the movement in temporalization. Of course, even the concept of world is a problematic one and would open out a further question that we don't have time for today. Nevertheless, I think the fundamental point that I'm making would remain a question to be dealt with. Time is outside itself because the now is outside itself, so to speak, in its necessary relation to the not now. And this somewhat metaphorical being outside itself of time is suddenly declared to be the eruption of the strictly spatial outside into the purportedly non-spatial inside. Derrida moves very fast here. He doesn't, by a long shot, fill in all the steps of his argument. This argument remains, nevertheless, compelling for many of us, including me. Indeed, for me, it opens depths of insight into metaphysics and into the passageway out of metaphysics that no comparably brief passage by any other philosopher has ever opened, despite the fact that when I read it closely, it eludes my understanding. The metaphor of the outside, as Derrida deploys it here, resonates across the conceptuality of metaphysics in ways that he does not develop here, and it is from these resonances that it derives its power. And this is the quick part of my paper where I'm going to conclude by giving you the outlines of what an account of these resonances would look like. The most important of these resonances is, of course, with the notion so deeply ingrained in the West, both inside and outside philosophy, of subjectivity as interiority. This notion is very closely related to that of the living present, but it isn't identical with it and does not provide Derrida with the conceptual resources by means of which he deconstructs the living present. The living present is, so to speak, the elementary unit out of which the substance of subjectivity is made. In seeking to establish the living present as the absolute core of subjective self-presence, Husserl, on Derrida's reading, seeks to track interiority to its lair, its innermost chamber. The discovery by Kant of the problem posed for interiority by the fact that it's a temporal flow had impugned the autonomy of interiority, its integrity, in the strict sense as the non-spatial inside. And now here came Husserl to restore this integrity, to place it on an absolute basis by locating its essence in the absolute self-presence of the living present, which should be an indivisible atom, right? but isn't, which is a problem, but one we can ignore, right? By according to the metaphysical principles that Husserl adheres to. Thus, when Derrida declares that space is in time, the largest resonance of the declaration is its challenge to the concept of subjectivity as interiority. Since, with the concept of subjectivity as interiority, philosophy itself underwrites the metaphor of inside and outside, and since the notion of the living present is so closely bound up with that of interiority, Derrida seems justified in throwing the latter question into the register of the former, that is, throwing the question of the living present into the register of interiority, which is the register of the question of subjectivity. And in fact, there's a good sentence in Speech and Phenomena adverting to that. Derrida says on page 76 of the English translation, the distinction between the grapheme and the empirical body of the corresponding graphic sign separates an inside from an outside phenomenological consciousness from the world. So that separation of phenomenological consciousness and the empirical world, that is present in Husserl and resonates with Derrida's reading of the living present as interiority. And yet, in the strict terms of the argument he makes, the justification is not so clear, for reasons I've already outlined. It isn't clear that temporal interval and the relation to otherness are rigorously to be described as a relation to the outside, when what we're considering is the relation, strictly speaking, of the living present to the not now, the now to the not now. So these two concepts intercommunicate, but in a way that remains more implicit than explicit. So I'm suggesting that philosophy underwrites, to a certain degree, this introduction of the notion of the inside. Yet, in a way, the fact that philosophy underwrites the metaphor of interiority as the name of the non-spatial inside only compounds the problem I'm addressing, because the philosophical metaphor is itself already incoherent. The idea of a non-spatial inside is a contradiction. For if subjectivity truly is non-spatial, as metaphysics insists it must be, then it is either nonsense or an inconsequential metaphor, not to be taken seriously, to call it an inside. Only something spatial can have or be an inside, have an outside. But then, if this is the case, can't the metaphysician say to Derrida, you're taking the notion of interiority too seriously, we don't really mean it? And then, wouldn't this forestall his attempt to force an outside into this inside? That might be the case if this were the only resonance of Derrida's terms of analysis, but there's a whole set of interlocking concepts, concepts metaphysics can't do without, as it might be able to do without the metaphor of interiority. A whole set of concepts that comes together around the matrix of the opposition inside-outside, the opposition that Derrida says in a terribly important remark in Plato's Pharmacy. He calls it the matrix of all other metaphysical oppositions, the distinction between inside and outside. This set of concepts that cohere around the distinction between inside and outside, connected with this distinction, all cohere around the central notion of bounded identity or form. The concept of form itself is derived from the root concept of a bounded physical entity. It's originally a spatial concept. The concept of form of, a horse that Aristotle talks about in the Poetics. He talks about the outline of the form of a horse. And that kind of physical outline of the physical form is what the metaphysical concept of form, eidos, essence, what this is based on. So there we find, at the very root, conceptual root of metaphysics, we find spatiality in a way that is not merely metaphorical, that is absolutely conceptually foundational. So the concept of form is derived from the root concept of a bounded physical entity, an object in space of the type Aristotle calls a this here, to de ti. Aristotle takes the spatial outline of the physical appearing of the object as also the outline of its being. Hence, eidos in Aristotle means both the physical form and the intellectual or metaphysical form of the entity. The purpose of this metaphysical ratcheting up of the physical form into the metaphysical form is to make the spatial boundary of the object's presence absolute as a boundary of identity. So the spatial outline as boundary and as impermeable boundary. The physical boundary can be breached or destroyed. The metaphysical boundary, which is originally nothing but a tracing of this corruptible physical outline, cannot be breached. The two senses of eidos, as physical form and as metaphysical form, are distinct but tightly bound to each other, as the concept of the living present and the concept of subjective interiority are tightly bound to each other. The constitutive underlying sense of all of these is that of a boundary between what is A and what is not A. In a sense that is perhaps not proper, yet more than merely metaphorical, what belongs to the essence is inside the form, the inessential is outside. We can thus list four distinct pairs of oppositions. This is the field of inquiry with which I'm leaving, the set of concepts, and it seems to me that the Derrida's account of the living present as inside with an outside has to be articulated in terms of these four sets of distinctions that are interrelated in very complex ways. First, the relation of the now and the not now. Second, the relation of subjective interiority and external world. Three, the spatial exteriority of object to object, object A versus object B, or versus whatever is not A. And finally, the essence or entity of all such objects, which is conceived as essence A versus whatever is not A. And I suggest to you that if we probe the interrelations of these four sets of concepts, that there is a very tight matrix of meaning of and of strong philosophical relevance and even rigor that we can give to the elliptical remarks that Derrida makes in Speech and Phenomena, and that lend support to Martin's reading that I initially thought was not there. Thank you.
Well, we have a few minutes for questions for Henry.
Yeah, because then it would just be some form of ultra-idealism, wouldn't it?
Right. And it would be the same problem as the problem of the relationship between God and world.
Right.
That all the moves that you've traced, in some sense, have been traced in theology in terms of that kind of problem. Don't you think? I mean,
I don't know. I'd like to hear more about that. Wait a minute. Let me get clear what you're saying. You mean like... theology has already done this before Derrida?
Well, there is a kind of quantology, if you like, or a kind of shadow effect in the argument concerning the ultra-transcendental and the empirical. The initial desire to have a very, very sharp boundary between the two and to see any fudging of that boundary or questioning of that boundary as somehow a mistaken understanding of the ultra-transcendental, and then a realization that somehow that boundary cannot hold. And insofar as the boundary can hold, it is question-breaking in that you are already affirming the absolute integrity of the boundary, which is something that you're supposed to be demonstrating. I think a similar problem, at least, exists in theology, and it's the basis of the Protestant Reformation. incarnation. I mean, that is to say, whether God is ultra transcendental in the sense of being out of this world, and yet somehow having a relationship to this world in terms of the creation of this world.
Well, have you read Martin's book yet?
Yes, I've read the important sections of it. I know the negative and positive infinitude argument. I'm not sure that.
Well, yeah, but that's not the. I mean, I think this is the negative theology bit about whether God is. I think Martin has disposed of the notion that there's any parallel between the arguments of negative theology and deconstruction.
Well, it's not. I'm not talking about necessarily negative theology that through some form of negation you actually prove something like the existence of a higher being. I'm talking about the structural parallelism of certain kinds of argumentation.
Yeah.
There is a kind of structural parallelism between.
Yeah, my instinctual reaction is to doubt that there's going to be a genuine parallel between the theological arguments and although of course there's affiliation, there's a relation, there's a the theology is part of the history of metaphysics, and that's what deconstruction comes out of, and it's a reworking of all of these things. But and we would have to sit down and spend a long time of it, but I can just tell you that my initial reaction is to doubt that that's is any useful kind of parallel there. Any parallel that could be drawn would be other than misleading as to what deconstruction is really up to. But yeah, I'm sorry, I can only write you a blank check on that.
So, is another way of understanding what you're talking about is a metaphor of spacing? I mean, like, because he's dealing with Husserl here, this is kind of phenomenological. So it's coming out of a description of experience. But at the same time, like in the Differenz essay, he's drawing, in terms of talking about writing, he's drawing all these impersonal understandings of writing. Like thinking about, you know, Martin quotes the Of Grammatology as a Positive Concept chapter, or as a Positive Science chapter, where it has to do with genetic inscription, it has to do, or there's the citation of Deleuze as a sort of an aggregation of forces, and there's a lot of impersonal descriptions of spacing and of writing that I think exceed what phenomenology can account for. I mean, is that another way of drawing on the idea, the problem here, that when the argument gets to this point, it's just like, it has to be a metaphor because a phenomenology cannot account for something that's impersonal, like an arc of writing?
There are other senses of spacing that Derrida uses, which are not problematic, the ones you're calling impersonal versions. But to the degree that the concept of spacing is developed precisely as an intervention into the basic concepts of metaphysics, it goes through this moment in Husserl. So whatever else that Derrida is doing with writing and DNA or whatever it might be is not directly relevant to the philosophical move that Derrida is making here.
Yeah, but I mean, aren't you kind of saying the argument sort of fails at this moment, that it has to be metaphorical?
No, I'm not saying it's... No. Oh, I'm glad you raised this question, because I tried to make clear that was the question. Is it merely metaphorical? And my answer was no, because even though it moves so fast here as to seem perhaps merely metaphorical,
okay.
There's a lot of it's rooted. It resonates deeply in metaphysics and other concepts of metaphysics that lie behind it, that have to be explicated in order to show the way in which it is more than merely metaphorical. That was my conclusion. That I think it does have genuine philosophical force that can be argued, but is not argued here. That's my point. Is that Derrida does not argue it here fully and adequately.
Well, to go back to an earlier moment in your paper where you're discussing Kant and are making reference to Martin's discussions about the becoming time of space and the becoming space of time. Well, in the discussion of Kant, you and I'm trying to remember if Martin treats the transcendental deduction and the unity of apperception as developed therein by Kant. That I can't quite accurately recall. But, you know, in your discussion...
Not at this point. Not at this point.
In your discussion, we're sticking to just the register of intuition, to the first portion of the first critique, the transcendental aesthetic, and talking about space and time in those terms. But the example of being aware of time through the drawing of a line, through this gesture of spatialization, well, for Kant, though, if you take a few further steps in the first critique and you come to what's arguably the heart of that text, the transcendental deduction, I mean, for him, the ultimate, we might say, ultra-transcendental condition for the other transcendental conditions even having anything to operate on is the transcendental unity of apperception. In other words,
yeah.
I could not even grasp the line or the inscription or the trace as a line, inscription, or trace were it not for there being this basic unifying function against which even difference
yeah.
itself becomes...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Martin actually says
yeah.
that. He says his introduction to
yeah.
this is that at elsewhere Kant tracks the synthesis of time to the transcendental unity of apperception, but that here, at this
yes.
one moment,
yes.
we have this moment at which he does... But in fact, the Kant at that moment is actually using this as a way of showing that the objectivity of the category of relation, he's not actually talking about the synthesis of time on my reading.
But it seems to be implicit since
but,
he's
But that's Kant, and we, yeah. can argue about, or agree about what Kant is saying, but I don't think it really has any ultimate consequence for Martin's reading, because he's using it as a way of elucidating something, of broaching something that he wants to say about Derrida. So I wasn't so concerned about whether I agreed with the reading of Kant or not.
I do think it has consequences in terms of whether or not we acknowledge that there is one ultra-transcendental condition which would be identified more along Derridian lines as involving the difference at stake in spacing. And I do think that you know, if Kant, you know, has arguments for why the transcendental unit of apperception would have to function in this exemplary transcendental capacity as an ultra-transcendental, that would then seem to be a kind of rival position, or at least one would have to have some kind of integration between the Kantian and Derridian Hegelundian positions.
Well, I think there's a simple answer to that, and it was one that Martin emphasizes, is that the whole Kantian position is based on Kant's taking as absolutely fundamental the principle of identity as what in terms of which everything must be deduced has to be in harmony with the transcendental validity of the principle of identity, and that's exactly where Derrida departs from classical metaphysics, is in his rejection of the principle of identity.
I mean, I don't think
that the unity of apperception doesn't have any other grounding than the necessity of unity.
No, well, anyhow, this would be a longer discussion to have, but I actually think there's a
That's
weird
why
way
in
which,
in
yeah, Derrida's reading of Husserl, for instance, in Speech and Phenomena is remarkably similar to what you get in Kant when you go even later into the first critique into the paralogisms of pure reason. But anyhow, that would be a discussion to have for another time.
We'll probably come back to this with Martin's response.
That's right. You can ask Martin about this.
I think we probably need to move on to the other two other papers.
Thanks very much, Henry.